Some matches are temporary, but your privacy shouldn't be. With Line 2, you get a second phone line just for dating. No need to share your personal number until you're ready. You can chat, text, and even block numbers, all while keeping things fun and private. It's perfect for online dating, blind dates, or just keeping things light. When you're ready to move on, Line 2 lets you cut ties without any drama. Dating should be fun and carefree. Line 2 keeps it that way. Ready to date on your terms? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, sponsored by Cooker, spelt Quooker, pronounced Cooker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Also does filtered sparkling water too. Today it's another special.
Woohoo!
Today we're having a conversation with Mike Viking, who's from Denmark. He is the CEO of the Happiness Research Institute in Copenhagen. And he's written a book called The Art of Making Memories, How to Create and Remember Happy Moments. I have interviewed him before. He's obsessed with happiness. I interviewed him on Sunday Brunch once before. Lovely man. He was doing his little book of Hygge. I can't really pronounce it, but that was good. He's basically just obsessed with how we're going to be happy. This book is quite a long book, as you can see, Mark. An in-depth book. And it's just full of experiments and research and different ideas of how to make memories. You know what? Why not let's meet
him? Well, just very quickly, I would say he practices what he preaches, and he is a very happy man. And this was a very joyous hour we spent with him. I've got a face ache from grinning. Such a lovely time.
Lovely. Let's meet him. This is Mike Viking.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, write into Dear Lovejoy.
Mike, thank you for coming on the podcast today. Welcome to my kitchen. I bought you a present. I buy all my guests a present. But I used to buy wine for people, but I've decided to go woke and become the new woke Tim. And I decided to buy sustainable gifts. And I found this, and I thought it was just so bizarre that I thought I'd buy it for you.
Bee bombs.
It's a bee bomb. Now, and what a bee bomb is, let me tell you what it is. It's because this is, as we're going to talk about happiness today, I thought this was great because this is you doing something where you probably get nothing back for yourself. What you do is you throw these things out. They're like little bombs. And what they do is they put wildflowers into your garden. You don't need to do anything with them. You don't need to water them or do anything, throw them out there. And it puts plants that bees love to try and get bees back. It contains 18 species of wildflowers. I'm not sure I can give it to you.
I cannot take it on a plane.
Because it says native to Britain.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking. I'm flying back to Copenhagen tomorrow. Can I have a bee bomb on a plane?
No. You can have a bomb. But you can't, because you can't take native British plants back for the Danish bees won't like it. I think you might have to re-gift that to someone.
Can you
give it to your publisher or someone?
Listen, I'm going to throw it out the plane while we fly over Britain, and there'll be a trail of bee-friendly plants.
I was really happy with that present because it was such a bizarre idea that you're gonna people are selling something that has literally no benefit to you. It's the benefit to the world. It's such a bizarre concept that we're now thinking we can sell stuff where you get nothing. I mean, it's a bit like art, but at least you get to look at art and things like that. So. Anyway, apologies for that.
Thank you. I didn't get you anything.
Don't worry. Okay. Why are you so obsessed with happiness?
I think we're all obsessed with happiness. I think we're all trying to solve some of the same questions I try to solve. I think we're all interested in what makes a good life, how to improve happiness, how to build better cities, better policies, better countries. So I don't see myself alone at this. But I started working professionally with happiness 7 years ago. I was working for a think tank in Copenhagen focusing on sustainability. Now, this was before the bee bump movement. But I've been there for about 7 years, and I started to notice how much was happening globally with happiness research and happiness in politics. So UN passed a happiness resolution. They started to commission the World Happiness Report. You had different governments, including the UK, starting to say, well, you know, let's look not only whether we get richer, but also whether we get happier. And let's start to measure progress in a broader term. And I thought there's a lot happening with happiness research, and Denmark is always doing quite well in these happiness rankings, and there should be somebody looking into that. And then I thought, I really want to look into that. And this was 2012, and this was also just around the financial crisis or in the wake of the financial crisis. So I also thought it was a little bit risky to start something as a happiness research institute, but I just couldn't let go of the thought. And I was laying awake at night thinking about the different projects you could do. And then on the personal side, what happened was I had a mentor at the company I was working for who I really looked up to, both sort of professionally and privately. And he unfortunately became very ill and died when he was 49. And many years ago, my own mother had also died when she was 49. So I just started to reflect, well, what if you only live to see 49? What are you going to spend the next 15 years doing? You can continue with this job, which is fine, and it's stable and well paid, or you can start this thing you are super passionate about. And then I essentially just quit and started out with what I thought was a good idea and a bad laptop. and I think that's going to be the best decision that I'm going to make in my career.
Okay. Well, just before we move on, can I ask you, I've just been to Copenhagen last weekend and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Stayed in a hotel. Everything in there was environmentally friendly. In fact, there were signs everywhere to make it more environmentally friendly. I really enjoyed the experience because I keep on saying on this podcast, as consumers, we're ready for it. We're desperate for it, in fact, and it makes us feel good.
Right.
To do things which are environmentally friendly. I just think the supermarkets and society and the companies and businesses behind where the public are with it, and it's proven recently, maybe with the younger population, their strikes and all their protests. Actually, the protests were happening whilst I was in Copenhagen, so it became even more prevalent in my mind. Mm. What is your view of Britain, being someone from, this is an unfair question because you're obviously going to be speaking to my audience who are predominantly British, but what is your opinion of Britain? We're going through Brexit at the moment, and also how do you view us in sustainability and environmentally friendly?
Oh, so, I mean, I think you're doing well. Of course, there are countries that are even further ahead in terms of sustainability. But from a global point of view, you're doing well. And I think there is a large movement here in the UK as well for moving towards a more sustainable economy. And I think there's also a recognition both here and globally that what is good for the planet is actually also good for us. Mm. I think we've used to see sustainability and moving to a sustainable economy as a cost to us. It's something we have to give up. But I think there is a move towards understanding that we can actually create cities and ways of consuming that are not just better for the planet, but also better for us. Mm. And I worked in sustainability for about 7 years, and a lot of the things I was talking about back then, I'm still talking about today, but just with a different approach. Now I'm looking at what makes neighborhoods happier, what makes people happier. But it's some of the same conclusions I was drawing as back when I was talking about how do we make the economy greener. Copenhagen is a great example. So you were there recently. You noticed the amount of people bicycling around the city. So yeah. So me, together with more than 50% of people in Copenhagen, we cycle to work. The majority of members in parliament, they cycle to work. We don't do it because it's good for the planet. We don't do it because it's good for the health. We do it because it's fast and it's convenient and it's a nice way to get around. All the other things are welcome side benefits, but we do it because there's been a large investment in infrastructure that allows people to move around Copenhagen on foot, on their bicycles, and that invites people to take that mode of transport, making the city better, making the city less polluted, making the roads for the people using cars less congested and making people healthier and happier along the way. So I think there's a lot of
yeah, but in fairness to London, so just so our population is absolutely huge. Our
right.
population of London is bigger than the population of your whole country, I believe. So,
yes.
So it's harder to get the infrastructure together. However, I do think we should be working towards it, definitely.
Exactly. And I mean, every city has challenges, right? So here, London is huge. Mm. In Norway, one of the challenges is that they're really hilly. But I've seen in one of the Norwegian towns, I think it's Bergen or Trondheim, what they've done is they have installed a bicycle elevator to help people get up the steep mountains. So I think, I mean, you are a super innovative city. Of course, you can create innovations that can help people get around in different ways.
But isn't it Scandinavia that everyone buys in, don't they? That's the difference. And I remember the first time I went to Norway, I said to my friend, what's that toll booth doing there? Why isn't it working? And they say, oh, they only open up when we need to pay for repairs to the bridge. And then it was opened up originally to pay for, it's actually a tunnel under a fjord. And they said it only opens up now when we need to pay for something. They open up for a while, get the money, pay for it, then they close it down. What's to pay for? I'm like, that would never happen over here. They just keep it open all the time just to make money. And so I don't know whether I've got this right or wrong, but I feel the public are buying into the officials and the officials are buying into the public and everybody trusts each other a lot more.
Yeah.
So you go to the airport and everything's new. Or there's brollies outside which anyone can use. If they're in Britain, they'd be stolen. So people are buying in more, aren't
right.
they?
There is a high level of trust towards each other and towards the government as well. There's also a wide public support for the high level of taxation. So I pay around 50% of my income in tax. But together with 9 out of 10 Danes, I'm actually happy to pay that. Because we see those money going back into creating good conditions for good lives.
Yeah.
So quality of healthcare, quality of education, but also improvements in our cities. I mean, the infrastructure around bicycle is one example. But maybe you also saw when you were in Copenhagen recently that they have cleaned up the water in the inner harbor. So it's possible to go swimming in the inner city in the summertime. And in all fairness, our summer lasts for about 4 hours and then it's back to winter again. But those 4 hours are pretty amazing.
That's so actually my Norwegian friend said, it's interesting for the government, if there's anyone in politics listening to this, he said the biggest problem with your country, as far as he could see, spends a lot of time over here, is no one seems to see what they're spending their money on. Because if you start building everything and making everything new, like we do in Scandinavia, people soon start going, I love where my taxes are being spent because I've got a new ward in the hospital and a new infrastructure and new cycle lanes and new trains, etc., etc. But we're not seeing a lot of it. And then people are probably, I'm out of my depth here because there probably are new stuff happening all the time. I'm just not seeing it, so.
But I mean, I'm a huge fan of Scandinavia. I think those countries are doing something right in terms of creating good conditions for good lives. But of course, every country have issues. Every country have challenges. We also have divisions internally in the Nordic countries. And in my second book, I actually talk about that myth around Scandinavia because I think it's an ideal we cannot always live up to. And I write that, you know, people leave the office at noon and free Lego is handed out in the streets. But then I write, you know, 5 years ago, there was a train that arrived 2 minutes late. But all the passengers got a designer chair and a letter of apology from the prime minister. Now, I thought that was obviously a joke.
Yeah.
But there was a journalist who wrote me and she wrote, did that really happen or was it a joke? And I wrote her back, of course it was a joke. Our trains are never late. They're doing well, but of course you have people that are happier or less happy than the national average.
But even with the way you treat criminals, it's different, isn't it, in Scandinavia? My knowledge is more about Norway because I've got a very good friend in Norway. Don't you sort of treat criminals absolute rehabilitation? It's like, let's look after them, let's treat them well, so they want to go back and be good people in society, rather than over here we like to try and punish them
right.
as much as possible, I believe.
Yeah, Norway is extraordinary in that sense, and you're completely right that I think the focus, the goal in the sentence is more rehabilitation and making sure that when we let people back into society, that they can actually maintain a life outside of crime, instead of, as you say, focusing on punishment. And they can see that the, what's it called when a prisoner is let out and then a few years later is sentenced again, the rate of return, I guess, right, to the prison system is far lower in Norway than in a lot of other countries. So they're doing some things right there as well.
And the other thing they said to me, so I'm just hassling you here about Norway society, but I assume it's similar over the whole of Scandinavia. Sounds very racist, doesn't it? You're all the same up there, isn't it? But they were saying that, if I was talking to a load of Norwegians, they were saying that if you get caught for drink driving, it's not so much the punishment you have to worry about, it's or your peer group, your local
social status,
community. Your community absolutely will go down on you like a ton of bricks, because you could kill a child. And so drink driving is not punishable so much by the law as more by, you know, your society. Whereas we would possibly, I mean, I wouldn't, but people would overlook it maybe. I don't know. What is that true?
I think in a smaller society, I think the social punishment of doing something against the norm is probably harsher.
Right, okay. So there's so many people over here.
Yeah.
Just one final thing on us quickly is, as a society, what are you lot all making of Brexit, sitting there watching over the waters?
I mean, why are you going to leave us? I mean, we had a nice thing going, and I think, you know, Denmark and the UK were allies in Europe. We had a sort of healthy portion of skepticism, and we had that together. So I think actually Danes are sad, really sad, that the UK are leaving. And listen, right now you are on that issue, a divided country. Same we see in the US. There's also a large division there around Trump. There's also a division in Denmark around different issues. So I think what brought Brexit to the table, what brought Trump to the White House, we have some of the same mechanics in Denmark as well. Interestingly, there was a study a few years ago looking at voting behavior in the UK leading up to, in combination with Brexit, looking at the well-being level in the given county. And they could see the larger the inequality in well-being in that county, the larger share of people voted to leave. So I think that that calls for reflection on the importance of equality, that we are in this together, and we should sort of try and align or create some sort of consensus of what we're trying to achieve.
You've got to tell us at that point. I think it's really important for you to tell us about that fantastic study where I can't quite remember the experiment, but I know you've talked about it before. It might be actually in this book, I've read it again, but where they offer you a salary of 50,000.
Right.
Go on.
Yeah, so the question is, would you rather live in a world where you make 50,000 pounds and everybody else makes 25,000, or live in a world where you make 100,000 pounds, so twice as much as before, but everybody else makes 200,000 pounds? Now,
everyone knows the answer.
Well, what we see is that around 50% choose to live in the first world. Because people not only care about what they're able to consume, they care about the position in the social hierarchy.
Yeah, I'd go first.
Right?
I can't help myself. I would just think that would be, you know, you're better off to be better off than everybody else around you than worse off than everyone else around
you. That's what we see. And that's also what we see in a lot of countries that are doubling their GDP per capita. It doesn't necessarily mean that a lot of people become far happier, because if you're doubling the national income, everybody still stays in the same place in the social hierarchy. So, you know, you're driving your BMW and you're happy with that, and then suddenly the neighbor drives up in a Porsche, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's an American saying that goes, you know, a happy man is a man that makes $100 more than his wife, sister's husband. And I think perhaps there are some truth in that, at least when we see it, when we look at the data.
So what is the Happiness Research Institute? What do you do there?
So I know it sounds like a magical place. I know people imagine that, oh, we have a room full of ice cream and a second room full of puppies. And but I'm sorry to let you down on this one. So we are trying to look at happiness from a scientific perspective. So using data, using statistics, using a scientific approach to understanding the good life. And all our projects are trying to solve three questions. We try to understand, how can we measure happiness? Why are some people happier than others? And how can we improve quality of life?
How do you fund it then?
I ask myself that question every morning. How do we fund all these puppies? No, so we work for foundations. We work for some ministries, both in Denmark and abroad. And we work for companies. Mm. So concrete projects right now is we just did a study for the Nordic Council of Ministers, which is like the UN of the Nordic countries, looking at inequalities and well-being in the Nordic countries. Yes, we do have high average levels of well-being, but who are those people that are falling short in the Nordic countries? Another study is where we're looking at people with different diseases and see how different diseases impact satisfaction with life or well-being. So using large data sets with over 100,000 people in them, also a data set that is collected over time, so we can see when people develop Parkinson or Alzheimer's or different sorts of cancer. Mm. How does that impact well-being?
So what is happiness? Is it thought processes or is it a feeling?
I would say it's a feeling. It's an emotion. And to me, it's a wide concept. It is both sort of taking a step back, looking at your life, feeling satisfied with what you see. But it's also, you know, the different kind of emotions we experience on a daily basis, both positive and negative ones. And it's also a sense of purpose in life. And I think, I don't think there's a need to reduce happiness to something simple. I think it's fine to look at happiness or the good life as a dish with many different ingredients. I think a good life has to do with pleasure. I think a good life has to do with a sense of purpose, connection, feeling satisfied with your overall life. So we try to break happiness down and look at different components. And that's also what we do. I mean, if we talk about how is the British economy doing, we would also break that down into unemployment rate, growth, GDP per capita, how's the pound doing, export and so on. And that gives us a language to talk about how's the British economy doing. And I think that's also what we need to do with happiness.
Western society, we're trying to export our principles to the whole world. And yet the one thing we're not is happy. The one thing we haven't sussed is happiness. And in fact, is our society taking us further and further away from happiness? You talk about connecting. Digitally or whatever, online, social media, we're connecting a lot. But we're not connecting together as real people. Our communities are breaking down. We're moving away from our families. We talk about purpose. We're ending up in huge corporations with the equivalent of North Korea. Our corporations are run by one guy. They make all the money. We make none of the money. We're not a co-op anymore. So are we creating...
So if you're just listening in now, we're talking about happiness.
But I'm always whenever I go to developing countries, I always think what they've got over us is happiness, because they still have connectivity, they still have community, they still have a purpose. They've got to get up and feed their kids every day, and they, you know, or whatever they have to do. And I do genuinely think we're exporting nonsense at the moment.
I think in a lot of Western countries, we have been looking for happiness in the wrong places. I think there has been an overemphasis on wealth. What we see is, yes, wealth does matter, money does matter, but less than we think. So we can see on average, people who are richer are more satisfied with life, but the mechanism here is if you are without money, then that's a cause of unhappiness. So once we get to a certain threshold, once we get to a certain level, additional £50 per month is not going to matter how you feel. But we continue to act as it matters. But we see, like with everything else, diminishing marginal return. So the more you have of something, the less pleasure you get out of an additional unit. So first piece of cake, great. Piece number 8, not so great. Maybe it's B-bombs. I actually maybe it's actually one of the things that sort of break that rule, but also with money, right? So first 1,000 pounds you get, tremendously important for food, for housing. Yeah. If you're already making 100,000 pounds per year, you get an additional 1,000 pounds. You buy B-bombs for your guests, yeah, or your more expensive bottle of wine, right? So it doesn't really impact how we feel, but we continue to act as it does.
Mm. So.
Sorry to give you such a hard time.
No, I think you quite like those B-bombs.
He kept bringing up the B-bombs.
But being happy isn't the word happy. It's quite a weird word, isn't it? Because it's all encompassing, and we all go, I want to be happy. I want to be happy. But we also kind of want to be sad as well, because when someone dies, you want to go through the emotions of sadness. We want a whole range of emotions. Happiness is only one of them, or is that an all-encompassing feeling of contentment? Is that with our life? Is that how you define happiness?
I think we should embrace all the emotions we have as human beings. I think it's very important that we as happiness researchers say that unhappiness is part of life, and every human life will have periods of misery and struggle and sadness and bereavement and heartbreak and failure and disappointment. Again, if you're listening in for the first time, we're talking about happiness. But that's part of the human experience. Hopefully, yeah, we will also have periods in our lives where we are happy, when we have a sense of connection, where we feel loved, when we have a strong sense of purpose. But that's not going to be all the 80 years that I, on average, will expect. But what we should do is we should try and understand, how can we create good conditions for people to flourish? So how should we design our cities, our policies, our workplaces, our lives, so that people have the best possible conditions for experiencing connection and purpose and satisfaction in life?
And just on a very, I want to get onto your book now, but the distribution of wealth must be a huge problem, not only for each individual country, but for the world as a whole.
Yes. I mean, again, because we see this diminishing marginal utility, it makes good sense to have progressive taxation within a country, but also globally. Because if you give $1,000 to somebody who already has a lot of money, it doesn't make any impact. But if we give $1,000 to somebody who's struggling with making ends meet, now that's going to be a big factor in their overall well-being. It's going to reduce stress. It's going to reduce anxiety. It's going to reduce crime. So I think we're all better off with trying to level.
So is it tough for us? Because we're bombarded with how much people are earning at the moment. So you look at the head of, the head of big corporations or fashion companies, or even sports people, they're footballers, definitely, because we're always being told that, I mean, they're earning such amazing sums of money now. Does that make us feel a bit more miserable when we see that they're earning such huge amounts? They're earning in a week more than most people,
right,
earn, maybe in a year, or definitely a year, but maybe their lifetime or 10 years or something.
It is making us compare ourselves to an extreme absurdity. The larger the spectrum of comparison, the further down we probably are on that playing field. We can also see a similar example. If you introduce television to a village that have not seen how life is outside the village, you'll sometimes see life satisfaction fall, because suddenly the village is exposed to how does the middle class and upper class live in Mumbai or other cities that they were not aware of. So I think it's also one of the reasons why sometimes people struggle with social media.
Yeah,
because
definitely.
You are bombarded with these curated images of these perfect lives, and people are getting married and having these amazing vacations and running an Ironman, and this is the same guy on the same day, right? And I'm here. I'm eating leftovers, and my train was late again, and there was no designer chair from the government. And
I found with 24-hour news, I've had an addiction to 24-hour news. I remember when it started, when Versace died, and they just had a helicopter going over it, and I got addicted and drawn in. Nothing happened apart from we just kept on looking at blood splattered in Miami. And I just kept watching for any more news. And I remember that moment thinking, oh, I'm really enjoying this, just 24-hour news. And, you know, and then it was 24-hour sports news was happening as well. And I was just taking it all in. And now I get up in the morning, I refuse to put the news on because I think you can't just bombard yourself with some horrific thing which has happened a million miles the other side of the world. And I've got to show empathy for that. I've just got up. I can't afford to do that. Right. I've got to try and, you know, get on with my life and sort my head out. So I've sort of given it up, but I think it's been beneficial to me. I really do. Let's talk about your book then. It's called The Art of Making Memories: How to Create and Remember Happy Moments. You've written a couple of books before, by the way. I've read them. I've interviewed you about the little book of Hygge. Have I said that right? Hygge, which is great.
Hygge, yes.
Hygge.
Yeah, yeah.
Hygge. You got
close enough.
Hygge.
I've heard many variations.
All right. Hygge.
I've heard also Huggy, and I think Hygge. We should all just switch to that.
Huggy. Huggy, which is good because that's about how the Danish maintain their happiness. But this one's about memories. Do you think memories are important then for happiness?
I do. I do think it's part of the answer to those questions I mentioned before. I think it is one of the reasons why some people are happier than others. We can see people who are able to retrieve happy memories, people who are able to form a positive narrative about their lives are on average happier. And the sort of inspiration for the book came a year and a half ago. I turned 40, and that meant, statistically speaking, I had lived half my life, because men in Denmark, on average, we live to we're 80.
Oh, but I thought with the advance of medicine, they believe you're probably going to live to 100 now, so you're 10 years shy.
I was 10 years ahead of my time. But so I just started to reflect, right? Looking back, what were actually my happiest moments? What were my happiest memories? And how can I use that knowledge going forward?
Okay. The one thing which strikes me about memories, though, is that they can have a negative effect as well, because a lot of my memories, you talk about this in your book, actually, a lot of my memories are from my childhood and definitely from my teens and early 20s. Wow, I had a good time, Mike.
You did.
We all did. And we all look back on that time and go, what went wrong? That was so much fun. We had no responsibilities. We were earning a few quid. We had we had all our fantasies about the future and what was happening.
Right.
So we look back with rose-tinted glasses, but sometimes that can make me quite sad.
Yeah. And I think a lot of us have that feeling, and we can see that nostalgia is really, really powerful. It's also being used in advertising. It's being used in political campaigns. I mean, Trump's Let's Make America Great Again, that's a nostalgic foundation he's using there. But we do look back with fondness. And it's interesting when you ask people who are 100 years old to tell us their life narrative, or if we ask them...
Oh, can we do the experiment?
Yeah, we can do it. Yeah.
Because I think you're going to get to that, aren't you? Is this the bit where you...
I give a word cue.
Word cue.
Right.
So our listeners can try it.
Yes.
And then you can tell us what happens.
So I'll say a word, and then you think of the first things that come to mind, your memory, and then consider how old you are at the time. And it could be random words like water, or bees, or computer, or grapefruit. And what we would see, and when you think of how...
Can we do a few?
We can do a few.
Go on. Shall I do some for one from your book?
Sure.
Okay, wherever you are now listening to this, let's try this. Sunset. What's your memory for sunset? We'll do a few of these. Car. Shoes. Watch. And I'll do fish. So where you now think your memories. Now, Michael, explain what possibly happened.
Yeah, and then you have these different memories. And if you write down how old you are at the time of those different memories, and if you are 100... or older, we would see that a large share of those memories are from when people are between 15 and 30. And we have fewer memories from our 40s and our 50s and 60s. And there is a large bump around those formative years, or our teenage years and our 20s. in part because they are formative years, so they shape our identity, but it's also because at that time in life, we have a lot of first experiences. Mm. So first kiss, I was 16 and she was an Australian girl. First apartment, first
Any
job.
Good?
Yes, I mean, I had no frame of reference at the time. I mean, there was no benchmark.
Oh,
no,
I wasn't talking
so
about her,
best
talking
kiss
about
I've ever had.
Were you any good?
we have a lot of first experiences in those years, whereas in my 40s, I mean, first experiences are going to be rarer. And novelty ensures durability when it comes to memory. So that's also why people will experience that life seems to speed up as we get older, simply because we have less first experiences.
Yeah, so it's funny. So you claim that the first experience, the ones that stay massively in mind. It's funny you say that, because Sunset, that's kind of a holiday. Actually, it was in my teens, sort of thing. The car one was my first car, definitely 100% the first Renault 5. shoes with this rascal pair of shoes I had with a grey, like they were kind of grey with a funny tongue. Watch. Actually, the watch memory was more about the watch I have now, but it's a special watch that I bought myself when mm-hmm. I sort of started doing well. And then fish was my childhood goldfish, though I'm not sure what else I suppose I could think of fish that I eat. So you're right, I went straight back. So has my life been pretty worthless since I...
Let me say no to that one. But I think it's super interesting that we have such a large share of our memories from our formative years. And what I'm trying to do with the book is help people, you know, create more memorable moments so we will have
yes.
more happy memories in the future.
Okay, I love that, yeah.
And I think that was actually the biggest aha moment for me in researching and writing the book. Going from thinking of memories as something somewhat random and something I don't have really any control over, to thinking of memory as something I actually can influence. And I can actually sort of design what I and my family will remember. And I think that's really, really powerful.
Yeah, that is really powerful, yeah. If my memories, say just for instance, my memories, I've got a lot of good memories from going out in my early 20s, late teens. Is there a danger of me trying to keep reliving those and then finding misery now because I remember that so fondly? Mm. When I go back to drinking 20 pints of lager and going to a nightclub, it just doesn't feel the same anymore. And so I can't relive that. But I'm still, because I have to look at some of my friends and think, why are you still doing the same thing we were doing when we were teenagers? But are they just trying to get that, like a drug, the first hit, you're trying to get that buzz again?
They might. And we can see, I mean, they're actively doing it. You are reminiscing about it. And we can see when people reminisce, when people engage in nostalgic acts, we sometimes do it because we have a sense of loneliness or sort of loss of purpose. And we go back to earlier times. We go back to happy memories. We think back to experiences where we did connect with others, where we did feel a sense of community, where we did feel love, where we did have a sense of purpose in life. So it's something that counteracts loneliness. It's something that counteracts loss of purpose. And it's also why it has this sort of bittersweet emotion attached to it, because it was a very happy time, but it's not there anymore. So we enjoyed having it, but we lost it along the way.
But I suppose one of the big memories we have, we spoke to Dr. Julia Shaw on this show. She wrote a book about memories. We often remember some really... She says, by the way, we can decide what we remember. It's quite malleable, our memories. So it's quite interesting. But she also pointed out that we like to remember bad stuff a lot because it makes a huge impact on us. And I suppose why it makes a huge impact on us is it's for survival. Our memory is there also to make sure we don't keep on touching hot things.
Right.
Or...
Yeah. And it is, I mean, our memory is very sort of fluid and kind of an artist. So I think people mistakenly think of memory as this one place in the brain where you have stored this YouTube video of what happened. But that's not how memory works. So when you recall being 21 and having 20 pints at the pub, what happens is you use your hippocampus, which you have on each side of your head, And that collects bits and pieces from around the brain and recreates the scene. So it will take information about what it looked like, what it smelled like, probably not good, and how you felt about the whole thing. And then you will recreate that scene. Sometimes you will add stuff that didn't really happen. So the hippocampus can also get really creative. But it also means the more we think of a certain memory, the stronger that memory gets, or the more likely we are to remember it in the future. In that sense, our memory is a bit like a muscle. The more we use that, the stronger it gets. In the book, I also say that memory is a little bit like Santa. If nobody thinks of it, it ceases to exist. So I think the perfect image of memory is like a really muscular Santa. I mean, right. Really buff, really ripped Santa. So that's a way you can visualize how memory works.
I like the idea that you can create fake memories as well. I've got a friend called Rosalie, and we went for a cup of coffee after I'd interviewed Dr. Julia Shaw. And I was talking about how we could invent a memory ourselves. And I said, look, let's just pretend I turned up to this coffee today in a clown's outfit. And every time I see her, I go, do you remember that? Now in my mind, I cannot unthink
right.
the fact that I wasn't in a clown's outfit. I looked all right that day, but I cannot unthink the fact right. that I'm in a clown's outfit and that thing. And I believe she thinks the same. It's amazing. We've inputted a memory into our minds, which is completely fake. So it's interesting stuff. I love the idea of making memories, though. Oh, but before we go into that, can you tell me what the difference between a semantic memory and an autobiographical memory, as you point out in the book?
Yes. So the first, the semantic memory, is you knowing that Paris is the capital of France. We have no probably recollection of when we acquired that knowledge.
Yeah.
Probably sometime in school.
Yeah.
But we cannot sort of revisit that experience. Episodic memory or autobiographical memory is if you have been to Paris, then remembering that trip to Paris. So it's a much more vivid experience. Maybe it has a soundtrack, a taste, a scent, and you can travel back in time. So it's the time traveling aspect that makes it different from semantic knowledge. So semantic knowledge is knowledge that we all share about the world. Episodic knowledge or episodic memory is your experience of your time in the world.
Yeah. So the bit you're working on in the book, which is great, is the bit to manipulate your life or your brain and your life with the autobiographical memory to try and give yourself some really good experience and to keep on having good memories all the way up until you're 100, not right. just stop. All right, I'm wrestling with the idea constantly. I love this concept, by the way, and I love the book. It's really fascinating read, and you've got some great suggestions there, and I agree with them all. I'm always wrestling with the idea, as Mark will laugh now, with the idea of free will and whether we have the ability to, whether we're just machines or we have the ability to decide our own destiny. This book is making me believe we do have free will.
Why?
Because you can manipulate your life right. to give yourself good memories. We've just forgotten. I'm not sure we've forgotten. We're just lazy and we're not doing it. You can create memories every day if you wanted to. We can't keep that many. But your suggestions through this book, I keep thinking, brilliant idea. Yeah, we should do that. Yeah, why am I being lazy and sticking in that bloody routine that I do, which doesn't create any great memories?
Yeah. It's a super interesting question. And I mean, we can...
Oh, somebody at the door. Oh. It always happens during the podcast. I'm so sorry. But let's just carry on.
Okay.
Mark, will you get it? We are genuinely in my house, in my kitchen.
It's very cool.
Thing, yeah.
So, I mean, I think we can go even further saying, do we have a free will? Yes or no? We can also ask ourselves the question, is it ever too late to have a happy childhood? Right.
Oh, great. Okay, go on.
Because as you say, you know, if we can choose our memories, if yeah. we can choose what we retrieve of memories from our past, from our childhood, is it then ever too late to go back and retrieve happy memories and construct a narrative that I actually did have a happy childhood? I think that is a really fascinating question. I don't have the answer to that, but I think it is interesting to see how memory, false or not, impact our behavior. So I also mentioned that in the book, that if you plant the false memory in participants in a study, that when they were a kid, they used to love asparagus. These participants will then start to eat more asparagus. They'll be more likely to order asparagus in a restaurant. They'll be willing to pay more for asparagus in a supermarket. And I think that's interesting to see how we think of the past, even if it's a false memory of the past, it impacts how we act here and now.
So let's talk about some of the things we can do to make memories. Basically, you've got a few lists in here of different things that are good for creating strong memories. Can you go through a few of them?
Yeah, so earlier we talked about the importance of first experiences. Mm-hmm. And I'm very much in favor of first experiences in a gastronomical sense. For example, what I did personally over the summer was I went to a restaurant with Helena, my girlfriend, and it was one of these new Nordic restaurants that source local ingredients. And we had a tasting menu, and one of the 16 dishes were ants. Nice. That was the first time I had ants. It's also going to be the last time I have ants. But it was a very memorable evening. But in the book, I suggest that people could organize what I call the Apollo picnic. So the concept is everybody bring an ingredient they have not tried before, or a dish. So I don't recommend ants, but if you're going for Mexican food, maybe some of you haven't tried habanero chili. So you bring that, it's going to be a memorable experience. It will push you out of your comfort zone. Other people are also going to remember the first time you had habanero chili. And you do it around July 20th, because that's the day of the moon landing. So it's the Apollo mission. That's why you call it the Apollo picnic. It also means every once in a while, the media is going to talk about the moon landing, the Apollo picnic, and that will trigger your memory of that afternoon where you went to the park and had habanero chili. Mm. So that's one thing you can do. But it can also be something as simple as stating when you are happy. So I had a conversation a couple of weeks ago with a Polish lady, and she had read the book, and she was reminded of a time when she was 8. And they're sitting at the table, she and her mother and her sister, and she remembered there were some yellow flowers on the table, and they were having this colorful Polish dish, and they're happy and they're laughing and they're having a good time. And her mother says, "I hope you remember this moment." Mm. And here we are 30 years later, and she does. Just by her mother pointing it out. And of course it's a potent ingredient, but also something you can overuse, because if you, every time you sit down with your kids, say, "I hope you remember this moment." Mm. Shut up, Dad, right? So we can also overuse it.
Unusual helps you make a memory, doesn't it? I went to one of those tasting restaurants in Norway, and it was like 8 courses of local food and local, and then 5 glasses of wine with it. And I remember saying to the waiter, "What if I don't, you know, you're pairing this wine with the food. What if I don't like one of the glasses of wine?" And he said, "Don't drink it." And that is my memory from the night. Literally, I thought he'd say, "We'll exchange it." He went, "Don't drink it." And I, and because of that, I laughed so much. I was like, "Fair point. Okay, don't drink it." And so that was my memory. The other thing is interesting, because you talk about holidays. I struggle with holidays, and I'm glad your book came along, because I've said on this podcast before, I fixed holidays. And I think I might, you can tell me the research on this, but when I've decided that to fix holidays, what you do is when you go on holiday, you aim to do one thing. Mm. The rest of the time you're there, you're just living. But you go, "I'm going to go for this restaurant. I'm going to go to that baseball match. Or I'm going to do this art gallery." If you aim for one thing, one experience, then you achieve it. And it's a successful holiday. Whatever happens the rest of the time doesn't matter. But if you just try and pile in so much stuff, it all becomes a bit of a mess. Mm. What's your research in the book on holidays?
Oh, so there is a famous thought experiment by Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize in economics. He's a psychologist, and I like to refer to him as the Beyonce of behavioral economics. But he did a famous experiment. He's done a lot of variations of this. But if we made you put one hand in water for 60 seconds, and the water is 14 degrees, so it's quite unpleasant. And then after the 60 seconds, we make you take your other hand, also in water, for 60 seconds, 14 degrees, but then add 30 seconds with 15 degrees. Still unpleasant, but less unpleasant than the 14 degrees. And then we ask you, which of those two would you like to repeat? Now, you don't know how long it took, but you're more likely to say, I'll go for the second one, even though you had as much discomfort as the first one, plus additional discomfort. Because, as Kahneman says, our memory of an experience is formed by how it was at the peak and the end of the experience. Something known as the peak-end effect. And he distinguishes between the experiencing self and the remembering self. The experiencing self is the one that sort of lives our lives. It's who we are right now. We experience the world 3 seconds at a time, 500 million times over our lives. The remembering self is the one who keeps track of those things. And it's also the one that makes decisions. It also means sometimes they have different opinions about experiences. So the experiencing self would have chosen the first trial, the cold water for 60 seconds, but the remembering self who makes the decisions, he go for the 90-second trial. So in that sense, you know, the remembering self is dragging the experiencing self through things that are worse. So I call the remembering self kind of a prick. But the thought experiment was, imagine you were to plan a vacation.
Yeah.
And at the end of that vacation, you forget everything.
Yeah.
So no memory, mm-hmm. no photos, nobody there to tell you how it was. Would you plan that vacation differently to how you are usually planning your vacation?
Yeah.
Yeah? How would you plan it?
Just wouldn't do anything, really. I reckon so. There's some woman recently who said she's given up taking a camera on holiday with her, like the phone sort of thing, or taking pictures, because she found out that she was trying to capture all the moments to try and remember them back and put them on Instagram. Whereas if you don't, you just go and enjoy yourself. So you go just purely arrive, go, what can I do to enjoy myself today? Rather than planning to do stuff to make sure there's memories.
Yeah.
Is that true? Is that right? Am I close?
I think what can be helpful for people is caring a little bit less about what to post on Instagram for others to see. Spending too much time on getting the perfect photo and the perfect filter and the perfect caption. I think what can be quite liberating for some is to have a private social media account where you post pictures of what actually happened from your everyday life. Because I think in the future, that can be actually really fun to look at. It's not going to be interesting for the rest of us to look at what you had for breakfast, and well, it still isn't. And how your home looked, your way to work. But in 10 years from now, those things are actually going to be interesting for you to see, and it's going to trigger memories of that time. So that's one of the suggestions in the book: have a private social media account where you store things you want to remember in the future.
First and last are fascinating, aren't they? Because a lot of stuff is sold on first and last. A lot of bands have done their last ever gig and then redone their last ever gig and then got back together and then done another last, because people want to be at the last gig. That's a memory, isn't it? The last gig, as well as the first.
It's probably also a sales trick. I mean,
yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, but yeah, aren't we selling that on the idea that you're going to remember you're at the last gig? It's all based on that, isn't it?
I think there is a lot of businesses, experiences, and perhaps also products marketed as a memory maker.
A memory maker, right? Yeah. Well, people do it all the time. Right. Come here and we'll make your memories. Right. This is where the memories are made.
Yeah.
The theater of dreams.
Right. And I think we're all searching for creating a life that's unforgettable, and you know, we're searching for memorable moments.
I think we also want everyone else to remember our memories as well. That's what Instagram's about, isn't it? Hey, look what I've done. Please remember that I'm brilliant and what I've done and achieved. Bad memories can be good memories though too, can't they? I made my daughter, she wanted to go and see Edinburgh University, so I said get the coach. It was a 10-hour coach journey. And I said to her, she was going, really? And I said, yeah, you'll enjoy it, you and your friends. And on the way up there, she texted me going, this is so uncomfortable. And I said, yeah, but you'll enjoy it. She got to the other end. I said, what was it like? She goes, horrific, but I enjoyed it. Because you're with your friends, you're in a horrible thing because you're sitting on a coach and it's uncomfortable and you're tired. It goes through the night and you can't sleep that well. But you get to the other end and you're like, wow, what an adventure.
Yeah.
Bad memories can be good memories, can't they? I was just thinking about one then. I was driving through LA with this woman who lived in LA. And I went to stop at a traffic light. It was downtown LA where the sort of... It was during the, what was it, during the late 80s or 90s, lots of gangs around at that time. And I pulled up and she went to me, what the fuck are you doing? Don't stop. And I went, the traffic light. She goes, don't stop at a traffic light. Don't stop your car. And I went through and she goes, oh my God, I won't let you drive if you stop. And I was like, what? She goes, it's dangerous. And when we got to the other end, I've got this amazingly brilliant memory because I was somewhere which felt so dangerous at the time. And the fear in her voice was incredible. So whether it was true or not, whether I was allowed to stop or not, but the bad experiences can create actually good memories too.
Yeah.
It's life experiences. Is that right?
It is. Yeah. And I mean, so what I also did for the book was we collected, I think it's the biggest global study of happy memories from around the world. And we have 75 different countries included in the study. And there's, now you tell that story, there's one memory from a British woman that comes to mind. Less dramatic than the gang area in LA, but she and her, and she's a woman in her 30s, I think, she and her family decides to go to the beach and have breakfast. And they hadn't done that before. And they go out there and it's cold, it's windy, they can't get the fire going. They end up eating this half-cooked porridge. They're covered in sand. But she says, now, looking back, it's one of the funniest experiences in her life. It's unrivaled family time.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
They're sitting under these huge blankets and eating horrendous food.
Yeah.
And it brought them closer together as a family, like the 10-hour trip to Edinburgh brought your daughter closer together with her friends.
So in
that sense, you know, some things might actually be worth the struggle in the long end.
Yeah.
And I mean, also what she could do, the British lady, is perhaps if she wants to make sure that her kids remember that experience, is, for example, she could go back to that beach and collect, if she has daughters, maybe she could collect some nice rocks and then turn it into a necklace, because that will be a manifestation of that experience they had together as a family doing crazy stuff, eating horrendous food on a windy
beach. Other humans make you happy, basically. Often it's other human interaction, isn't it? That's a good memory.
It is. I mean, it's often the best predictor we have of happiness is whether people are happy with their relationships.
Yeah. People on their deathbed talk about relationships. They don't talk about material things. Have a very short shelf life of happiness, I believe.
Yeah.
Another thing you say on the book, two other things I want to cover. One of them is make and celebrate milestones. And I think this is great. You're basically saying birthdays, anniversaries, make good memories with those sort of things. I've sort of in my life been slightly anti-religion, I think. I don't have a religion. And so I've just never really understood it. A lot of them don't make that much sense to me. However, the one thing that I have in recent years really thought religion's great is they have lots of milestones. Mm. They have lots of things like you get married in a church, if say you're a Christian, and you get a christening when the baby comes along. You know, birthday is an important thing. Then you've got Christmas, which is going to church and everything. And every time you finish one thing, there's another one you can look forward to. Well, we're going to do the harvest festival, or we're going to do this. You know, and so I think religions are very good at plotting your way through, creating another little memory.
Mm.
Do you agree with that?
I agree with celebrating milestones, and some people use religion for that. We can also create our own personal milestones. I mean, before you mentioned you bought that watch when you started feeling better or doing better.
Yeah.
I think that's a great idea. And celebrating milestones we have set for ourselves, I've done a similar thing. So for me, it was a big personal milestone to publish my first book. And I had actually saved money to buy a chair I really wanted. And I waited.
That's so Scandinavian.
It is so Scandinavian.
Is it Eames?
Yeah. No.
Mark's saying it's Eames.
Yeah. I know it's so cliche Scandinavian. I was sitting in my eco village thinking about how great taxes and gender equality is on my bicycle while I was buying this chair. Anyways, I was saving for this chair and I waited until buying that chair until I published the book, because now that chair is a manifestation of that accomplishment it was for me. Similar to you're buying the watch for something that was important for you, right?
Yeah. How long did this book take you to write? Because there's so many experiments and so much information in here, aren't there?
I mean, it's been two years.
Tip of the iceberg here.
Yeah, it's been 2 years since my last book, but it was really fun to write. So I try to write in a conversational tone. So having I'm basically imagining having a chat, an interesting conversation, hopefully with somebody across from me at the table. Blending in studies, what we found in research, combined with fun anecdotes. And this book, naturally, because of the subject, I could draw on a lot of fun experiences.
Yeah.
Also the time where I did a faux pas on national live TV.
Yeah, that was on this morning.
Yes.
And Phil and Holly.
Phil and Holly. And this was in conjunction with my last book. I was doing an interview around that, and naturally I'm nervous. I mean, the show has more countrymen than, or more viewers than I have countrymen, and so I'm on there, and Phil says, "So earlier you've written the little book of Hygge, now you've written the little book of Lykke. What are you going to write about next?" And I thought his Danish was really good. And I also know a lot of people here in the UK, they've seen some of the Danish TV dramas, you know, The Killing and The Bridge and Borgen, as you pronounce it. So I say, you know, well done on pronouncing Danish. You must have been watching a lot of Danish porn. That's not what I said. I said, you must have been watching a lot of Danish porn, which is how we pronounce it. But he heard, you must have been watching a lot of Danish porn. So he starts to laugh. Holly starts to laugh. She says, you know, what did he say? I'm afraid to ask. And that's the end of the interview. But it was a quite memorable experience. And of course, I was completely embarrassed when I realized what they thought I had said.
I have to say, reading your book, there's a lot of good humor in it. It's a fun book to read because there's a lot of anecdotes and things like that. Let's do this final bit before we get on to the questions. Attention, pay attention. And that is something that we cannot do anymore. We've got our phones. I can't even watch TV without looking at my bloody phone. It's ridiculous now. I've literally no attention span at all. If we want to create memories, Mark's nodding his head there at me saying that. If we want to create memories, actually, we're better off paying attention.
Yes. I mean, it was not a question.
Yeah. expand on it.
No, but I think what, for example, what the Polish mother did before, we talked about before, make sure you call it out when you're actually feeling happy. When you sense your family's happy, ask them to pay attention to that moment. I did it personally. Also, this was researching and writing the book. So this was a couple of summers ago. I was on an island in the Baltic Sea and had been out spearfishing in the cold water, and was caught a couple of flounders, and sitting then on a warm rock, summer's day, just feeling really, really happy. I'm breathing deeply and just feeling happy with life. And I thought, what can I do to remember this moment? And I remembered Andy Warhol. He used the power of scent to travel in time. So he would wear the same perfume for 3 months and then never wear it again. So over time, he had this museum of scent, or museum of memory. So he could travel back to 1982, spring of that, by taking a good whiff.
Amazing.
So I thought, you know, any middle-aged man, what would Andy Warhol do? I saw a bunch of dried seaweed, and I thought, okay, I'll attach that scent to this memory, because then if I smell dried seaweed again, I'll be transported back to this moment. So that's part of it. But I think what I was also just doing there in the moment was being really mindful of that moment. Yeah. I was without my phone. It's not good to be underwater with your phone.
Yeah.
So I was without my phone, really present, deep breathing, just feeling happy with it all and paying attention.
I love this. I love the idea of time travel. I love that. And I suppose there's also slight traveling forward, because the anticipation of creating a memory must make you feel good as well. You know you're about to go to LA or you're going to somewhere and you think, I'm going to make some memories.
Exactly.
That also must have a nice effect on
exactly.
you too.
It is a fantastic time traveling ability. We can see also that we use, according to the studies I've read, part of this, the same part of the brain when we use our memory, when we travel back in time,
yeah.
as when we predict what will happen right. in the future when we travel forward.
I think someone should do an experiment on the tipping point of alcohol. Let's just take beer, for instance. Maybe 3 pints in, you're making good memories. 5 pints, no memory. or you wake up the next day and go, what the hell did I do last night?
I'll call up Carlsberg and see whether they're interested in sponsoring this thing.
It's funny, isn't it? Yeah. It's all going so well and now I can't remember it. There's one night in my life where I had an amazing night, apparently, and I just don't remember it. And it's so frustrating. So I'll tell you about that off the podcast. All right, there's questions I ask everybody. So I'm going to ask the same ones to you. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
I think it is actually trusting your stomach. I mean, the whole setting up the Happiness Research Institute, that was a gut feeling. That was paying attention to where my energy was lying. I really wanted to work with this field. That's where my passion was. And then I would have to sort out later down the line how I could make it happen financially. But I think as I've grown older, I've learned to listen a lot to the feeling I have in my gut.
Okay, what's something you think people should know?
Should know that they can actually influence what they remember and also become sort of memory architects for their kids and shape what they remember when they think back of their childhood in the future.
Also, I like this one. Take a pineapple on stage.
Right, yes.
That's something people should know.
So the story behind that is... I know that people struggle with remembering names. If we're introduced to somebody called Mr. Baker, that's out the window. But if we're introduced to somebody who is a baker, we remember that. Because a baker, that creates an image. He has a funny white hat. He works with a flour. And that's something called the Baker-Baker paradox. And I do a lot of presentations. And often it's easy to remember me because I'm the weird happiness guy. But sometimes I'll be at a happiness conference and there's going to be 20 happiness researchers. And then, you know, how do I make sure I stand out? How do I make sure that people remember me? They're not going to remember my name. So what I might do is I might bring something weird on stage, like a pineapple, because then I stick out, then people pay attention. And then of course I explain to them that I just brought a pineapple, so because we're 20 speakers, and later you can refer to me as the guy with the pineapple. So that's why people can bring a pineapple on.
Do you hold it? It's great that you do anything slightly different, and then people remember it. I remember this guy doing a speech once, and he just stopped. As one of those things where people do charity, and he stopped and just looked around the room, and he spent forever looking around the room. And I can't get that image out of my mind because it was far too long. And then he had the confidence just to carry on and talk. He didn't stop because he was nervous. He was just taking it all in. I was like, wow, that's a man who's really confident, because most people get on stage and just spurt, don't they?
Right,
that's
yeah.
What you have to do. I'm intrigued. My surname's Lovejoy, as you know, and I'm intrigued what people with the Baker paradox, how that goes down, what people imagine when they see Lovejoy. Because people don't forget that name.
No.
It's a really, I actually think half, not half, but a bit of my success is down to having that unusual name that people can remember. Any life hacks you've got? Travel tips, how to give up something, how to clean something, anything?
I travel a lot. So I spend perhaps 100 days per year traveling. So of course, any hacks there is important to me. I actually listen to a lot of podcasts because it's a way to get more. And I'm not just saying that because we're here, but it actually drastically improves the quality of my travel, that I can walk around airports, I can sit on a plane, I can be on the move with something interesting in my ears.
Which ones do you listen to?
I listen to This American Life, which is great. I listen to Freakonomics Radio.
Yeah.
How I Built This, about entrepreneurship, stuff you missed in history class. Interesting stories about everything. I think I'm more interested in an interesting story than a particular subject. Mm. So,
I've become addicted to Stuff You Should Know. Do you know that one?
No.
Two guys who just, they'll talk about Genghis Khan or something, and then they'll just for 20 minutes tell you about Genghis Khan and
Brilliant.
How many people he killed.
How many was it? Five? More than five?
Quite a few countries. Right. Can you recommend a book?
And I'm not supposed to say my own.
Not your own.
Yeah. I think the one I probably read the most times is The Great Gatsby.
Oh,
I think that's still a classic. I think there's still so much knowledge in that. I think every human being should read that at least.
Did you read it in English or?
I read it in English. Yeah. Yeah.
What age did
I know. You... I know it. You know, with my English, it sounds like I should read it.
No,
in
I'm just. Yeah. I'm fascinated. What age did you start? Cause does everybody in Denmark pretty much speaks English, don't they? What age do you start learning English?
I think I started learning it in third grade. I think they start learning it younger today. But I mean, yeah. And then I think one of the reasons why we also speak relatively good is that. We get a lot of British and American television, and we get it with subtitles. So at a very early age, you're exposed to the sound of another language, and then you slowly start to learn to read it, and sort of you can connect words and sound. But yeah.
It's so good, isn't it? It's amazing that you, because you just end up being able to go anywhere, well, most of Europe, you can all converse in English. It's fantastic. What was I going to ask you then? I can't remember.
But I mean, so on the language, I mean, I still need to concentrate more when I speak English. And I've seen it on videos when I've said something in Danish and then I say the same thing in English. I look so concentrated when I speak English. Yeah, it's really interesting. Actually, I get this really grumpy look on my face when I talk English, which is kind of an issue when you're a happiness researcher.
That was what I was going to ask you. I'm being racist again here, but can you understand Swedish? Can you understand Norwegian? Can each other understand each other, bits of the language? Or
yes.
How does it work?
Yeah, we can. I mean, there are also a lot of different dialects within the countries, and some are easier to understand than others. But yes, a Dane and a Swede and a Norwegian walks into a bar, and yes, we can understand each other. But yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So it's three languages for the price of one.
Fantastic. All right. Final question. What's the meaning of life?
Beyond B-bombs, I think it is. I think it's coming back to what we talked about earlier. I think it's finding the right balance between pleasure and purpose in life. Doing things we enjoy, as well as thinking about the future and trying to find a meaning and purpose with it all.
Mike, I thoroughly enjoy your company, as always. Your book's fantastic. Some great thought experiments in here. There's so much in here. We just tip of the iceberg. There's lots of experiments you can do and lots of things to get you thinking about how to make good memories. So it's a real good book if you want to learn how to do that. It's The Art of Making Memories, How to Create and Remember Happy Moments. If people want to follow you, what's the best place to go to?
Probably Instagram.
Instagram?
Yeah.
What's your address?
It's my name. It's Mike Viking, but spelled in that funny, weird Danish way. So MEIKWIKING.
And is the Happiness Research Institute, is that online?
Yes.
You go to that.com?
HappinessResearchInstitute.com.
Perfect. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank
Cheers,
you,
Mike. Thank you. That's Mike Viking. Thoroughly enjoyed that. It really has made me think about making more memories.
Yeah.
Because you kind of think, oh, I've done it, don't you? Do you?
Well, no. I was just thinking, actually, while he was talking, I had the weekend that just passed from when we were, from when we did the interview. I just realized I had a whole weekend of memories that are both past and I made new ones. So I went I went to see a gig with my friend Phil, who I've known since I was 5 years old, who I have a lot of memories with. And I went to see Liam Gallagher, who was from Oasis, who's from a band from my teenage years, very happy to, you know. And that was all very nostalgic. He plays all the old songs and stuff. And then
was it a good gig?
It was fantastic. It was a tiny little one in Manchester.
What was the atmosphere like?
Electric.
Were there lots of boys with the
No, it was pretty mixed. Bucket actually. Hats. And it's stuff. Pretty mixed actually. Okay. There was a few of those. But and then on the Sunday, one of our friends died this year, sadly. And to commemorate his passing, we had a cricket match, and it was all his family, all his friends, all his brother's friends. And so it was the most joyous day. And we made a new memory there, but we also talked about all the old memories we had of him and of growing up with each other, and all the different groups all had their own memories and stuff. And I was just thinking about that, and it was just thinking, I'm not going to forget that day. So, yeah.
Okay, go back to the Liam gig. What was he wearing?
He'll be wearing a parka, won't he?
I don't know.
Well, he'll be wearing a parka and moccasins and jeans and sunglasses.
Wouldn't he be wearing his new trainers? He's got a new Adidas trainer.
No, he always wears moccasins.
All right. What did it smell like in there?
Beer.
Did it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we were on a balcony.
What were you wearing?
I was wearing a parka and jeans and desert boots.
Were you really wearing a parka?
Well, I took it off. I was wearing a polo shirt, yeah.
Well, you don't have a parka, do you?
Right there.
Oh, that one. Okay. Yeah. I'm just curious, because I'm wondering, because memories, as we've spoken a lot about memories with, I mean, if you read this book, it's the same stuff Dr. Julia Shaw says. It's like our memories are so ridiculously bad because we remember for, I imagine, for reasons, like we remember bad stuff so we don't get deaded. Yeah. And you remember good stuff because it makes you feel good and you want to relive that sort of stuff as well, I suppose. But there's a lot of stuff you've got to get rid of because you can't remember it all, can you? So it's fascinating that if I ask you that question in a month's time, which I should try and remember, and say, hey, what was it like? What was Liam wearing? What were you wearing? What did it smell like? I wonder if you can recall it all, or it's just a feeling you recall.
I know what you mean. Yeah, with all those specific details.
Yeah, how much details can, or how much that. I'll tell you an interesting thing. We do the first and last. It's always bugged me, but I get it now. It's always bugged me, people are trying to sell them. Exclusive, first, you can have it here. That's always annoyed me, but now I get it because it sort of creates, you know, and the last as well. That sort of gets me as well. The idea of something being the last. It's the last ever gig or the last ever this. Does it matter if you've seen them second from last or last? Of course it does, because the last is the last one. That's where the memories.
Depends if you had a good time when you went there, you see.
Even if you had a bad time, you know, as we know, that still creates a memory. There's a time at Socceroma, and I can't ever get this out of my mind, when anyone mentions the words last, it comes in. So we're all working really hard at Socceroma. I so hope Neil listens to this, right? Because his memory of this is so different to mine, and over the years it's changed. So we're all working really hard. It's a Friday, and it's Concorde's last ever flight, right? Everyone's busting their balls to get the show out on Saturday, and everyone's looking for Neil. And where's Neil? He stood in the car park at Sky Sports waiting for Concorde to come over, the last ever flight. And we're like, why? And he's going, it's the last ever flight of Concorde, I don't want to miss it. And it's always amused me so much because it's actually a bigger memory probably in my life, thinking, you bastard, get inside here and do some work. It's a sodding plane. What does it matter? Do you know, Google it.
Do you know, it's really funny. They're really funny, those memories, because I have those sometimes where you were so, like, I reckon you were so livid with him going, you like, we're so busy and you're
out. I think the word's disappointed, Mark.
Yeah, no, but do you know what I mean? But then when you look back on it, it's now funny. But at that very moment, it was not funny.
Every time anyone mentions Concorde, I send, or there's any article about it, I always send it to him on a WhatsApp group. We're all on the Soccer M Boys. So it's like, hey, here's Concorde. Do you remember that? The time we're all working and you were watching Concorde. His memory of it is so different, though. He reckons he was out there. See, in my mind, he was out there for 2 hours with a packed lunch and a flask waiting for it. In his mind,
And his voice went, I'm watching the last Concorde flight. Is it like that? That's how you remember it.
In his mind, he was there for 5 minutes, right? Just quickly popped out and had a quick look and ran back in. I have it such a different memory. It'd actually be good to get us all together and work through what actually really happened that day. All right, this podcast is sponsored by Quicker. It's spelt Quicker because it's Dutch. That's why it's spelt Quicker. But it's pronounced Cooker. It's 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I love it. There's one there. It does your hot water. It does your cold water, so you can do your washing up. It does your 100 degree hot water, which does your vegetables. It does your brews. It actually, I use it quite often to get stuff off cleaning wise. It's also, by the way, environmentally friendly, because you don't have to, like a kettle, you have to keep heating the water up and down. This heats the water up and then it maintains the heat due to a vacuum. No idea how that works, but there's a vacuum involved. So it's environmentally friendly, better than a kettle. It also does your filtered water, which is delicious. And it does the best thing ever. It does chilled filtered sparkling water. Yes, bubbles straight from my kitchen tap. Mark loves my bubbles. He drinks them constantly. In fact, he's drinking them right now as we're talking. It's Quicker. Go to quicker.co.uk, I suppose. Or is it spelled Quooker? I recommend it. Mark, we've also got Beer 52 as our friends here, haven't we?
We have, Tim. We have beer52.com. They are a craft beer / ale subscription delivery service. They deliver delicious beers to your door every month with a different theme, so you get to try a lot of different types of craft beer.
Is it Beer 52 who knocked during this podcast?
No, sadly, every time that door goes, I hope it's them.
I bet because the last three podcasts we've done, the doorbell's gone. I bet people think we do it on purpose. We literally don't. It's like, Mark, go and ring the doorbell because it's light relief. No, it's like, it just happens every time we're on the podcast. The what was it which came through?
That book.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
All right.
So beer52.com/lovejoy. Go there, beer52.com/lovejoy for your free case of beer. You get 8 cans. You get a snack and you get a magazine. You pay the postage and packaging, which is £5.95. And the important sort of tagline thing is you can cancel at any time. So just so you know, you're not, you know, tied in for forever and ever. They're a reasonable bunch. We've met the guy. He came on here. He's a lovely chap. And he's really interested in what he does. And he gets some really good beer to your door. So
yeah, if you're interested in it, listen back to our last mailbag episode. But listen to our last mailbag. And that was when we basically interviewed him and had a little chat with him. I've known, he's a really interesting guy. He invented Super Jam as well. So,
and the reason, what we normally do when we discuss Beer 52 is we crack open one and try one. But it's just on the point of being too early to have a beer while we're recording this. Yeah. Otherwise, even I have a cut-off point. I know you can't believe
especially
that.
Especially as we've just had a conversation with someone from Scandinavia who aren't as uncouth as us.
Exactly.
They're much more sophisticated. How much do you love the fact that when he wanted to treat himself, he thought, like I went and bought myself a watch, he thought, I'll buy some furniture.
Yeah.
No one buys furniture! Furniture! I would never think of buying furniture to treat myself.
But I bet you it was a really nice, you know, I thought it might have been an Eames chair. Yeah. You know which ones I mean?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
I bet it was something very similar that you, if, when you walk into someone's house, you go, oh yeah, that's
I like
really,
that chair.
Yeah, that's really
like
nice.
That
yeah,
it's
yeah.
brilliant though, the idea. That wouldn't even come into my mind to treat myself to furniture. I mean, I've got furniture, obviously, in this house, but it doesn't feel like
we both sit on the same chair.
Mark's sitting on my lap as we speak. Mm. Oh, that's not very good. What do people think when they hear my name? What are they visualising? Love, joy.
Don't ask that question.
Just do it.
You're not going to like what you hear, Tim.
Love, joy. I'm sitting in my pants. What are you visualising? Love, joy. Right, that's it for this week's podcast. We'd love you to contact us. And if you've got any problems, we'd love to help you. We're going to do another mailbag very soon, so get them in quickly. It's dearlovejoy podcast@gmail.com. You can tweet us at Tim Lovejoy, or you can Instagram. I think it's TimLovejoy_official. I think that's my thing at Instagram. You can contact me on that if you want. Yeah, that's it. We'll see you very shortly. For the time being, peace and love, joy.
Bye.
Want to keep your personal number private but still stay connected? With Line 2, you can get a second phone line right on your device with a super simple app and no need for another phone.
Whether it's for online shopping, dating, or shielding your main number from spam, Line 2 is an easy way to manage it all. Ready for peace of mind without breaking the bank? Call, text, block, and more for only $9.99. Get started with line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in any app store today. Line 2, your second line simplified.